The early suburbs that once represented an escape from the city into a new, more rural neighborhood now have some of the same problems as cities. My guest, William Morish, is leading the charge to revitalize these so-called first-ring suburbs, the small communities which developed just on the edge of city centers, suburbs like Levittown and New Rochelle, where the Dick Van Dyke Show was set. Morish is the director of the Design Center of American Landscape at the University of Minnesota. In 1994, he and his wife, Catherine Brown, a landscape architect, were described in the New York Times as the most valuable thinkers in American urbanism today. Morish is currently directing an extensive study of metropolitan neighborhoods and is planning the first national conference on first-ring suburbs. I asked him who originally moved into the first-ring suburbs and how the population has changed.
The first-ring suburb, especially the most famous one, the post-World War II, is for the returning veterans, the post-World War II economic boom, people returning from the war, seeking a new life. These were the homes for the workers, for the new aerospace industries, and all the new industries that grow up around World War II and after World War II. These homes were famous ones, of course, is Levittown. And I might refer back, that's probably the most famous one representing the post-World War II community. These towns were designed as small communities with schools, small and inexpensive government, setting and using the economic base of the central downtown. They commuted into work into downtown from these, quote, bedroom communities. We're now going through the next succession in its ecology, the next version is a more diverse economy. We've got a larger aging population, and we also have new family formations coming in with different family structure and ethnic backgrounds. So what might have been construed in much literature about a homogeneous world is now becoming a heterogeneous reflection of the diverse American family structure.
Give us an overview of some of the typical problems that the first-ring suburbs are dealing with now.
First one is just the aging infrastructure of its housing stock. The houses themselves have served their lifetime and no longer compatible or competitive in the larger market. They're small and on small lots, and therefore they're affordable to many people, but they're constrained and therefore need to be renovated. The community is starting to see a raise in the cost of social issues as they become areas of affordable housing. They have declining tax base and increased social costs. So the city is under some financial stress as the jobs and economic life is pulled out by the second and third ring suburbs. They've also become pass-through through communities for a lot of congestion between the city and the edge city of the second and third ring. So they're caught right now between the possibility of being a great place for new families to locate and renovate affordable housing, and at the same time they're looking at social and economic issues they've never had to face with a small economic tax base.
Do you think that changing lifestyles have affected life in those first-ring communities today?
Oh, very much so. The typical family that the society was building for example, in even as middle as the 1970s here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, 79% of the families in the area were what called the nuclear family, one wage earner, two-parent family. We now have 25% of those families meet that bill. Most of us are working parents and a lot of single parents. And that structure, which relied heavily upon the automobile, And
the wife at home.
Yeah, well, somebody at home driving, yes. The wife at home managing children and easy access over to the school has fundamentally changed. And those conventions that was built upon have changed now. We don't have that lifestyle anymore.
Didn't you once point out that stay-at-home wives and mothers were considered a part, more or less, of the infrastructure in those early suburbs? It was just assumed that the wife would be around to take care of certain things.
Very much so. I mean, it was one of the key subsidies for the system, along with 90-10 highway funding, where federal government paid 90% of the highways to build very inexpensive highways and subsidize them for there. It relied heavily upon the wife or someone at home to be able to move everybody around, since there was no public transit in many of these communities.
Now, another thing that you point out that has changed the nature of life in these first-ring suburbs is that there's lots of suburbs that have gotten built up around them, so they're no longer on the edge. They're no longer kind of semi-rural. They're totally hemmed in by all these other rings of suburbs.
It's a phenomenal period of growth in the last 50 years. I mean, you have communities that were literally on the edge of their rural areas 50 years ago and now are way within inside the city. In fact, they were referred to now as the inner ring. And many suburban communities, such as second, third, and fourth ring communities, kind of just lump it into the central city as sort of one big problem. And yes, they are hemmed in. They have a limited ability to expand their tax base by attracting new business because they have a limited amount of land area available for economic development because they're predominantly residential and have little space for job development.
What are your fears of what will happen if we don't creatively address the problems that the first ring suburbs are having now?
I believe that if we miss this opportunity, we're going to end up with using the term brownfield, which is usually referred to as land that has been left back by industrial waste and abandoned by industrial land. We'll end up with, I think, an economic and social brownfield that's going to be quite profound. If it declines and deteriorates as we've seen in Central City, it'll be a more profound problem to Central City because it does not have the tax capacity that a Central City has. And we'll be looking at an area which will be bypassed by economic development and may even hurt Central City renewal as people begin to look at it as just another example of larger city problems. People will turn away and start focusing on the edge city and farther out.
My guest is William Morish, and he's the director of the Design Center for American Landscape at the University of Minnesota. One of the big issues he's working on is trying to reverse the decay of first-ring suburbs in America. The model you're trying to create for these first-ring suburbs is what you describe as a metropolitan town. Would you describe what that model might be?
Well, the metropolitan town is an idea that we've been working with that as our cities become parts of a large metropolitan region, economic region, we're beginning to focus on the idea that towns by themselves cannot exist without partners and linkages to the larger system. Instead of just seeing the first ring town as an independent, self-supporting system, the way they're going to sustain themselves in the future is to begin to start seeing them as what we call the metropolitan town. Something of the scale of the town, which people, I think, are looking at politically and socially as the proper scale within a metropolitan area, something they can understand. And then metropolitan means it's hooked up. It has sub-regional partners. It's hooked up to transportation. It's part of a social safety net that many communities share. They have access to jobs on either side. They can no longer afford to operate as independent and autonomous units.
Well, how do you deal with something like public transportation in an area where it doesn't exist, or not much of it exists?
Yeah, the issue of transportation, it's quite phenomenal. These towns are going from a period where they've had not to deal with the issues are not very complicated, and they're now having to go to very complicated and integrated issues. Actually, locally, there's a group called the Northwest Human Services, which has actually been working with the medium-sized employers in the first-ring and second-ring communities and talking to them about where their employees live and what their needs are. And they're beginning to develop a transit system about between this partnership between employees living in the first-ring and their employers right nearby and beginning to articulate shuttle systems and also helping reroute and rearrange the metropolitan transit system. So actually what's interesting is transportation has to be brought in on the community's terms from the sort of grassroots base. It can't just be superimposed down upon the city.
What's the best example you can think of a first-ring suburb that has become revitalized?
It's just beginning. There are several examples that are forming now. Just recently, I received a letter from a group of first-ring suburbs around Cleveland have been organizing both politically and planning-wise, and they have been discussing issues of transportation and slowing down highway growth through their community and beginning to look at transportation on different terms. So many communities, there isn't, I think, a finished example yet, but there are many people who are now raising that issue and forming coalitions. And I think that's the most significant first step, is that they're beginning to see the partnership, the shared concerns, and beginning to look at positive solutions rather than just becoming NIMBYs.
I think one of the disadvantages of a lot of first-ring suburbs is that there's no center, there's no real downtown, there's no real cultural centers. Maybe there's a multiplex. Is there a way, do you think, of designing that in after the fact?
Well, one thing about cities is you get to redesign them constantly. The whole notion of city and towns is they're constantly getting added to. So the idea of adding a center after a city started is always possible. Many first-ring communities have rediscovered the notion of creating a 3 or 4 block main street area out of an old strip street that used to be strip commercial. There's a community right here in Minneapolis, outside of Minneapolis, called St. Louis Park. It has a street called Excelsior Boulevard, which had the traditional 50s strips commercial on it. They've just discovered that, one, there's a great piece of land there that could be used for higher and better use. And two, they have a big demand for multifamily housing, which is not going to be placed inside the middle of single-family houses. So they're rethinking this strip street and beginning to go back to the notion of maybe a boulevard could be a place rather than just a passage for automobiles going somewhere else. So they're actually talking about redesigning the speed of that road and getting it down to actual 35 miles an hour rather than 50, and from there beginning to sort of make an identity for itself. The revival of schools, I think, is the other issue, too.
How so?
As schools are beginning to... there's actually some discussion between school districts, both in city and the first ring, to begin to start sharing school buildings, and also the school beginning to become the access to the information highway and job retraining for many of the people that exist in the first ring. So it may become much more of a 12-hour place rather than just a K-12 activity.
My guest is William Morish, the director of the Design Center of American Landscape at the University of Minnesota. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with architect William Morish, who is planning the first national conference on the decaying of America's first-ring suburbs. What are some of the strengths inherent to some of these first-ring suburbs that you think can be used to help revitalize them? You know, for example, we've talked about how some of the housing stock really doesn't hold up. And, you know, particularly some of the houses that were built in the 40s and 50s were seen even in their time as being, you know, houses of ticky-tacky that all look just the same. Mm-hmm. So where are the strengths?
Well, its first strength is taking the number one rule of real estate is location. Its location is perfect for a metropolitan area. You can be halfway to work whether you're in downtown or out on the edge city. You can be in a 20-minute drive. So as people begin to look at housing and the two workers in the family have one job in the suburbs and one job in the central city, many of them are trying to understand how to move into the first ring. What adjustments do they make? That brings them to two issues, schools and housing stock. Schools, as they're beginning to become involved in understanding and recreating the schools in a more diverse and integrated place. The second one is the housing stock, and that's a really interesting design and technology question. They're small lots, typically 40 by 150 lot parcel, 800 to 1,000 square feet. Technologically quite innovative at their time in the 1950s, using much of the technology developed in World War II, light frame construction, plywood, very revolutionary, and mass construction techniques which are still used today. The challenge is, one, in changing the zoning so that people can begin to add bedrooms. You can make a pretty good investment in the cost of the building, but you're going to have to add bedrooms and bathrooms and kitchens. And also to look at innovations in technology, such as new heating systems to window wall systems and even pre-development and pre-made elements to renovate essentially the houses to make them maybe more compact in square footage, but actually environmentally and technologically more sophisticated than the second and third ring suburbs, so that the trade-off is a more sophisticated, maybe even technologically more advanced house, but maybe you have to buy one less car. And one less car means that you can get $50,000 more in mortgage, which means you can invest it back into your house, which is a better investment than investing it in a car.
There are many first-ring suburbs that are racially and ethnically mixed now, and you see that as one of the real strengths of these communities. Are you hopeful that they will actually stay racially and ethnically mixed?
I think this is, others agree with me, that this is probably one of the great challenges for America. We've always talked through our history about building communities which are equitable and accessible to all. And as the first ring begins to become much more heterogeneous, both economically, class, and ethnically, I think this will be a real challenge to see whether we really can build an integrated community. These are working families that are moving in, revitalizing an area, not with huge government support. And the question is, are we going to deal with the racial issue to understand that this is a great economic tool, the balance of ethnic and class working together to stabilize our metropolitan areas? If we can't pull it off here, which I think is a very direct and physically, I think, easy problem, then we're not going to be able to pull it off in the more complicated areas. I think it's going to be a real challenge to us.
How did first-ring suburbs become your issue?
That's an interesting question. Actually, it came about as we began to look at the metropolitan issue. We worked quite heavily on inner-city neighborhoods and began to aggregate neighborhood questions in the inner city. And as we began to start following some of the economic trends, a lot of the work done by a representative, Myron Orfield, from our state legislature in Minnesota, who's written a book called Metropolitics, who's shown that the statistics of the first ring, the increase of poverty, the change in social demographics is starting to have a negative effect on the first ring. We began to start asking the question, if we are going to have to renovate and take advantage of this great opportunity, how would we do it? So we're essentially following the statistics that are beginning to emerge in various different writings that people have produced recently.
Have you ever lived in a first-ring suburb?
Yes, I have.
When?
It's actually the town of Fresno, California, but it was built quite heavily after World War II, and a lot of those lightweight plywood houses. Yes, I think a lot of the baby boomers grew up in first-ring suburbs.
Did you grow up in Fresno?
Yes, I did.
And what did you learn from living there? You know, that you can now apply
actually,
to your work.
Yeah. Well, for a little kid out in the first-ring suburb, at that time it was pretty wide open, and you could run around all over the place. It was pretty safe. You could ride your bike everywhere, and there wasn't any traffic. I think what was interesting is that there was a lot of social interaction going on in the suburbs. A lot of kids sharing things, running around, meeting each other. I don't think it was really the cultural void that many writers have referred to it recently. I think that the challenge, as I've seen areas like Fresno and others age, is that the downturn is quite significant, and that system is no longer viable after a while. You become pretty isolated once the area becomes congested and begins to infill. So for a period of time, I think it was probably very useful and raised a lot of pretty good kids.
What kind of neighborhood do you live in now?
I live in the central city of Minneapolis. I live in an old turn-of-the-century neighborhood very close to downtown.
What do you like about living downtown?
It's accessible, actually. It's very easy access to the central city and the cultural resources. I'm just two blocks from the Walker Art Center and the Guthrie Theater, so it's very easy to get to cultural activities.
Well, Bill Morrish, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
William Morrish is the director of the Design Center of American Landscape at the University of Minnesota.